Folkcast 010, October 2006.
Welcome to the October edition of Folkcast, where, as usual, we have the very best in folk, folk rock, singer-songwriter, and roots-based music. I'm Ken Nicol.
And I'm Phil Widows. This month, we'll be offering the chance to win a copy of the latest album from Ralph Mattel, with the Folk Notes calendar from Baba, and Ken will be putting his instrument through his guitar workshop and showing you all how to set up for easier playing.
But most of all, we'll be talking to my old friend and musical partner, Chris Weil, who tells us how she once got career advice while sitting on the toilet.
But first, a blast of quality folk rock to scare away those autumn chills. This is Black Rat with A Scouring Song.
Good cheer. So we'll go and we'll scream just to keep him in shape, and he'll last for many's the year. Before the gods who made the gods have seen the sunrise pass, the old horse upon White Horse Hill, he was cut out of grass. Grows over again. Before the gods who made the gods had seen the sunrise pass, the old horse upon White Horse Hill, he was cut out of grass. Our cider and beer, and if we're still here in the next 7 years, we'll raise our glasses in cheer. Before the gods who made the gods have seen the sunrise pass, the old horse upon White Horse Hill, he was cut out on grass. And Squire would come by to see us at play. He won't care for such sports as these. Before the gods who made the gods had seen the sunrise pass, the old horse upon White Horse Hill, he was cut out of grass. We'll go and we'll scream just to keep him in shape, and it'll last for many's the year. Before the gods who made the gods have seen the sunrise pass, the old horse upon White Horse Hill, he was cut out on grass. The old horse upon White Horse Hill, he was cut out on grass. We'll be right back. give ear to these words that I write. Although I am a rover, and roving I take great delight. I set my mind on a pretty girl who oftentimes did me slight. My mind was never easy till my darling came into sight. Was down by Silas Garden. One evening late I took my way, and there I spied this fair pretty maid. These words to me she did say. She bade me take the haze as the leaves grow upon the tree. But I being young and foolish, with her I could never.
That was the trad song Rambling Boys, as presented by English three-piece Pavlov's Cat. And before that, From a Cat to a Rat, you heard a scouring song by Leicestershire's Black Rat, which comes from their new album, Telling Tales.
As you may know, Folkcast friend Ralph McTell has just released a four-disc box set called The Journey, which covers his career from wannabe bluesman through to where he is now, one of the most highly respected songwriters and guitarists on the folk scene. What you might not know is that just last month, he released a new studio album, Gates of Eden, on which he covers songs by his musical heroes, including Blind Blake and the Reverend Gary Davis, as well as several tracks by Woody Guthrie and Bob Dylan. And we have two copies of Gates of Eden to give away to Folkcast listeners, so get your competition head on. But first, to get you in the mood, here's a cut from that box set. Ralph playing one of the songs he heard from Blind Blake, The Drybone Shuffle.
Thank you.
great double dose of quality playing, though. First, it was Dry Bone Shuffle by Ralph McTell, and that was followed by Graham Bellinger with his own tribute to Mr. McTell, called Ralph and Davy Go Picking in Paris, which is from his latest album, Black and White Days. Here comes the competition bit. We know the Ralph in the title of the tune is Ralph McTell, but who is Davy? To be in with a chance of winning one of two copies of Ralph's latest album, Gates of Eden, simply tell us the full name of Ralph's famous folky Parisian picking partner. Email your answer to us at contact@folkcast.co.uk by Saturday, October the 22nd, when two winners will be plucked out of the virtual hat. Each will receive a CD copy of Gates of Eden, and our thanks go to Ralph and Iconic Music for those prizes.
And if you visit our website at www.folkcast.co.uk, there's full details of that competition question and how to enter, so don't delay. Righty, more music. Here's some chamber folk from Irish artist Caroline Lavelle, and it's gorgeous. Caroline has worked with or been a member of De Dannan, The Chieftains, Massive Attack, William Orbit and the Afro-Celt Sound System. A couple of months ago we played her version of Gently Johnny from The Wicker Man. And here's another cut from her album The Distant Bell. This is Innocence Sleeping.
Sleeping beside you I dreamt, I woke beside you. Waking beside you I thought I was dreaming. The motion of landscapes, of oceans is inside him. He is so innocent, sleeping. No protection is needed. At some times the heart of us contains all there is, there being no more than him. Have you ever slept beside the ocean? It is just like this. I can sleep well beside him. At such times, the heart opens, contains all there is, there being no more.
A while to fill the space of
the room where you so recently lay. In a corner of the war, feel the echo of a haunted moment. My fatal flaw, feel the way you daze and pull on a minor chord. Exploration of a new direction. Your melody unwinds and stands up for a midnight mountain climb. On the news there are people calling back out for the leaving ones love to come cascading back for a momentary rethink of something they once had. Somehow let go of, so keep breathing. Keep breathing. Keep breathing. Keep breathing. To know that you can steal my devotion. Pause, play, rewind. See the words connect with some kind of interface. On the news there are people calling back out for the leaving ones love to come cascading back for a momentary rethink of something. So keep breathing. Keep breathing. Keep breathing. Keep breathing. Keep breathing.
You've just heard Keep Breathing by London five-piece Pie Finger. And we both think that's a fantastic name.
We love it.
We love it, yes. They were preceded by Caroline Lavelle and Innocent Sleeping. As ever, there are full details of all the artists we play on Folkcast in the show notes section of our website. Click the archive button and follow the link to this month's show notes from there. If you hear something you think is particularly special, why not drop the artist in question an email? In fact, why not drop an email to the artist in question telling them you heard them on Folkcast and that you think they are fab?
And now it's time for the Folk Notes calendar for October. Around this time of year, I like to hear stories of pearly royalty, discover how to see into the future through the medium of the face pack, and learn what the Romans had to do with Halloween. Now, there's only one man who can tell us things like that.
Some say he can trace his family back to crazy man Michael.
Others swear that he communes with unicorns on moonless nights. We just know him as...
first Sunday of October, the Pearly Kings and Queens of London celebrate their Harvest Festival at the Church of St Martin's in the Fields. The Pearly Kings and Queens are a Cockney tradition that was begun by an orphan called Henry Croft in 1875. A street sweeper around the Somers Town Market, he began the tradition of sewing pearl buttons to his clothes and raising money for charity. Today there are Pearly Kings and Queens for all the London boroughs, and they can be seen in their full spectacle at their Harvest Festival. On the 18th of October is traditionally a day when young women could get a glimpse of their future if, before going to bed, they put on their faces a mixture of spices, honey and vinegar. It was thought that they would dream of their future husband. Punky Night takes place in Hinton St George, Somerset, on the last Thursday of October. Traditionally on this night, children carve their punkies, or pumpkins, into jack-o'-lanterns. Once carved, the children go out in groups and march through the streets, singing traditional punky songs, calling at houses and competing for best lantern. The streets are lit with the light of the punkies while the children sing, "It's punky night tonight, it's punky night tonight, give us a candle, give us a light, it's punky night tonight." Halloween, of course, closes the month of October. The name is a corruption of All Hallows' Eve, November the 1st being the Christian feast of All Hallows. Halloween has its origins in Samhain, a Celtic feast marking the end of summer and the beginning of winter. It was believed that the barrier between the worlds of the living and the dead was thinnest at Samhain, and that noise and fire were needed to scare away any evil spirits. So, if you want to have a traditional Halloween party, make sure you have a bonfire, and make sure it's a fancy dress party, because the Celts believed that it was only safe to go out on Samhain with a mask or some disguise, so that the evil spirits abroad would not recognise you. Now, if your party features a game of apple bobbing, you'll be following a tradition started by the Romans, who worshipped their god Pomona, the god of fruits, on the same day. And should you go trick-or-treating, you'll be honouring another tradition, that of Mischief Night, where people would go from house to house dressed as ghosts or spirits, demanding food or drink from the nervous residents. And many people think that trick-or-treating is an American invention, but it isn't. It's an old English custom that went out of fashion and is only now coming back to us. Well, whatever your celebrations, I hope you'll have a good one. I'll be back in November, but until then, this is your Uncle Baba saying, fare thee well.
Thanks, Baba. And who could have guessed that you'd be giving us a blast of punky rock on Folkcast? Baba's music this week was The Shetland Set from the album Wild Wood by Shira Carman, which is available at magnatune.com. Now, if you physically struggle to get the best out of your guitar playing, here's Dr. Ken with a few tips on making life easier.
You know, one of the most important and certainly one of the most neglected areas of guitar playing is that of having your instrument set up correctly. By this, what I mean is maximising the ease of your guitar's playability. And the way to do this, basically, is by making sure that the strings on the guitar are not so far away from the fretboard that holding down a chord or being able to play nice clear notes is any harder than it needs to be. I mean, playing the guitar is hard enough as it is, so why make it more difficult? Now, I taught the guitar for a number of years, and it's hard to estimate just how many students came along to their first lessons with guitars that were barely playable. And I hate to think how many people actually give up playing because they reach the conclusion that it's something that's just physically impossible. And you know, just because a guitar is new and off the shelf, this very often doesn't mean that it's actually set up well. Most new guitars I've come across are not set up very well at all. Of course, there is quite a bit more involved in setting up a guitar than just lowering the strings towards the fretboard. And we are going to find out exactly what's involved now as we talk to Roger Bucknell at File Guitars. Hello, Roger, and welcome to Folkcast.
Hello, Ken.
So, anyway, how's life treating you up there in Penrith?
Oh, just full of stress as normal, but we're surviving.
Oh, dear. You've been up there for how many years now?
10 years here now.
10 years, my God. Mm. And, of course, previously you were in Kirkham, which lies very close to the File Coast, hence the name.
Yep. So when we moved to Penrith, I didn't think it worthwhile changing the name to Penrith Guitar, so we stuck to it.
I think that's a good move.
Yeah.
Definitely a good move. First of all, every instrument you make that leaves your factory, is it actually set up to play as well as it can be set up, or do you set it up more for it being transported to places? Because obviously it takes a while for wood to settle down, so...
Yeah, well, we do our best. We try very hard to set the guitars up 100%, but there is a range of expectations from the customer. One player won't want the same thing as somebody else.
Sure.
And the guitar will move around a little, particularly in the first few months of its life.
Yeah.
So we try to take account of all that before we send the guitar out. If we're dealing with the customer directly, then we do try very hard to take account of his personal preferences when we're setting the guitar up on the bench. And then we always suggest that, given the chance, they bring it back or take it to some sort of guitar technician after the first few months when it's settled down to its new home.
Right. And, of course, the extent to which wood settles and moves around depends on all kinds of things, like humidity.
That's probably the most important one, yes. And in a country such as this, which is generally wet, the summer is the worst time of year for humidity. You might think that the hottest time of year will be the driest, but it isn't so.
Mm-hmm.
The summer is the dampest part of the year. And by contrast, of course, the winter is therefore the driest time, but it's made worse by the fact that during the winter you also turn your central heating on,
sure.
Which dries all the moisture out of the air, and it's a very bad environment to have a solid wood acoustic guitar.
Yeah. And things like like string tension as well. I mean, you always put the same gauge strings on your guitars.
Yeah, unless requested otherwise, yes, we do.
Mm-hmm.
We send them out with what are called light gauge, 12 to 54, 12 to 53, although really they should be called medium gauge because nearly everybody uses these 12 to 53s.
Sure.
Medium gauge are too heavy for most people, and extra light, you don't get the best out of your guitar that way, although if your style demands it, by all means go for them.
Yeah. So like, if somebody actually brings you a guitar to be set up, what sort of procedure do you go through?
Well, the procedure is much the same for any make of guitar, any style of guitar really as well, even electrics. A general assessment of what's going on, first of all, the height of the action, the string height above the fingerboard, is the first thing that strikes you when you look at the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that you would look for would be the straightness of the neck, because that affects the string height, although it isn't directly related.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the two things that you're able to adjust reasonably easily. On an electric guitar, you can usually adjust just by turning screws here and there. The truss rod can be tightened, the saddle bridge can be raised or lowered. On an acoustic guitar, it isn't quite so easy. You can do the same thing with the neck, but to adjust the height at the bridge means the saddle has to be raised or lowered by filing bits off or putting packing underneath or making a new saddle.
Yeah.
So it isn't quite so straightforward.
Yeah.
If I take a guitar in here, the one setting up, you first of all look at the string height, and then hold the strings down against the fingerboard to get an idea of how straight the neck is. It's quite common to see people looking a longer neck to get an idea of straightness, but that doesn't give you the complete picture. It's more accurate, and you'll find professionals tend not to do that. They use the strings as a straight edge, hold the strings down at the first fret and maybe the 12th or 14th, and see what sort of gap there is between the strings and the frets at the 5th or 7th fret.
Sure.
And there should be a tiny gap, because you don't want the neck dead straight.
Yeah, I've always... But I've always wondered about, you know, this looking along the neck business, because I've done that in the past, and I've never really known what I was doing.
Well, if you look along, you're seeing two or three different things at the same time.
Yeah.
First of all, you're seeing the strings, which are, you know, will be in a dead straight line if they're tuned up. You'll see the tops of the frets, but you also see the top of the fingerboard, and you'll see the edges of the frets where they're filed off at an angle to meet the fingerboard.
Yeah.
And all those three things might be slightly different lines. You can get a wrong impression. And also, the chances are you will see a curve, but you won't know how much that curve is.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to know how much the curve is. It's called relief.
So you can adjust the curvature by changing the tension on the truss rod?
Usually, yes.
Yeah. Which actually, I was just wondering, because I know some guitars don't have truss rods in the necks. So
well,
how do you go? They do.
Yeah, there aren't many that don't. First of all, let's just define a truss rod. I would define that as something that's adjustable.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else will be reinforcement. Classical guitars tend not to be adjustable, and there are one or two guitars, such as the things made out of carbon fibre, that tend not to be adjustable because the movement in them is small. When you tighten the strings up, the movement is small. There will be movement, so it would be sensible to have an adjustable device if you want to be able to get the optimum playing action. But because with nylon strings there isn't much tension, and because with a solid graphite guitar there isn't much movement, quite often people don't allow for adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
So there's those. Those don't have adjustment. Just about every other guitar does have adjustment in it, and it's a thing called a truss rod. It's not the same as reinforcement.
Now, obviously, this is something you touched upon earlier, just for a moment. But the style of the player and the gauge of the string has so much to do with the way you set a guitar up. You know, some people have different requirements, don't they?
Yes, quite definitely.
And
the obvious thing to point out is the difference between an acoustic player and an electric player.
Yeah.
Electric guitarists almost invariably have a much lower action and lighter strings than an acoustic guitar would have.
Sure.
It isn't just because of the feel of the guitar and the style. It's because a solid body guitar doesn't vibrate the same way as an acoustic guitar. So you don't have the strings set to the same height. If you have a very low action on an acoustic guitar, it will buzz. The same action on an electric guitar won't buzz. So you have a high action on an electric guitar, you have to work a lot harder than you need to, so you can have a lower action.
Yeah.
Mostly because the body is so stiff, and the neck sometimes so stiff, that the strings themselves don't vibrate very much.
So the further down you bring the strings, of course, the more crucial it is for all the frets to be at the right height, or level, or whatever.
Yeah.
How do you make them level?
If we started from the beginning, then they're put in level to start off with.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a couple of issues here.
But they can move, can't they?
Well, the frets don't move as such. The frets can become worn, of course, and if you only ever play down the bottom end of the fingerboard like most of us, and never go up the dusty end, then those are the frets that get worn. Someone like yourself, Ken, who plays up in every possible part of the fingerboard, is more likely to wear the frets more evenly.
Yeah.
The other part of movement is, this is where the frets in effect are moving, because the neck is made out of solid wood, which will respond to changes in moisture and temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So the neck can move around a little bit. Also, adjusting the truss rod won't necessarily adjust the curve of the neck in exactly the fashion that you want it to.
Yeah.
So you might end up with a slight S shape in the neck when you really want a slight simple curve.
Sure. And one thing I've noticed, especially in older guitars, is the way the bridges are raised. The strings can pull the bridge up, can't they? You can see that.
Yeah, the tension of the strings will pull the bridge forwards and twist it normally, raising the belly of the guitar, as it's called, behind the bridge, pulling it up into a sort of a hump behind the bridge.
Yeah.
That's sometimes regarded as being a good thing. There are some American players that will say never trust a guitar without a hump.
All right.
Because it's a sign that the guitar is built quite lightly.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also a sign that the guitar is moving under tension, which is not a good thing.
Yeah.
So we try and avoid that. But some movement in the front of the guitar is inevitable and even indirectly desirable.
Yeah, now the price of a setup can vary an awful lot, can't it?
When we do these sort of first setups and the guitar has been bought from you, we tend not to charge. It's sort of like having a 1,000-mile service on a guitar as part of the deal. After that, it might be something like £40, which would include a little bit of work on the frets, which would be levelling them by filing them flat in certain areas and reshaping them. It could include adjustments to the nut, or in our case we have a zero fret. It could include adjustments to the saddle, even maybe replacing the saddle. Then on an electric guitar, you've got things such as intonation adjustments and pickup settings, so you get even volumes. On acoustic guitar, that isn't quite so simple, but you might sometimes be looking at intonation adjustments even on an acoustic guitar.
Sure. And of course, some people might be clever enough to do this at home.
And there's no reason why not. It's obviously much better to practice on something of lesser value than an expensive guitar.
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, they need the correct tools as well as the knowledge.
Well, yes, you do, but, you know, like most guitar makers, you know, I started off with hardly any tools, and you can do an awful lot with very little. You don't have to buy things from specialist suppliers. You can do things with a chisel sharpening stone, a carborundum stone, and a little bit of wet and dry paper. You can do most things that way.
Oh, well, I think I'll get to work now. And
well, yeah, you try on your guitar first, not mine.
Okay. Well, Roger, thank you very much for affording us some of your time and imparting some of your knowledge and advice to us.
You're very welcome.
All right. Thanks a lot, Roger. Cheers.
Bye, Ken.
Okay, so there you have it. If you're struggling with the dreaded F chord or those root 5 or root 6 bar chords, it might just be time to take that guitar along for a full service.
Thank you, Professor Nickel. And there'll be more guitar tips in a future edition of Folkcast. So if you've got any questions that you want to put to Ken about anything that goes twang, send us an email to contact@folkcast.co.uk. And if you're into your guitar players, you'll love this next bit. Chris Weil is a singer, songwriter and musician who has risen to folky fame with the Albion Band, as one half of the world-conquering duo with Julie Matthews, and occasionally singing Sandy Denny songs with today's Fairport Convention. But before all that, Chris was musically paired with Folkcast very own Ken Nickel. Now, with a new solo album in the can, and with Weil and Matthews heading out on tour in Germany and in the UK over the next couple of months, we took the opportunity to talk to Chris and find out all about her musical roots and where she's heading now.
I am loved before and I have been loved just the same. Decided I would stop before I took that road again. The reason had no reason when you sailed into view. And I've never walked the line I walk with you. The day to day
say welcome to Folkcast, Chris Weil.
Hello, hello Ken, hello Phil, nice to be here.
Greetings.
I've been interested as to what your influences were at the very beginning. What actually motivated you to make you into the singer that you are?
Oh, well, I mean, I can remember being a singer almost as soon as I could speak. My dad was an opera singer and a beautiful tenor voice, and he sang in the choirs, various choirs, and in local amateur operatic societies. And my sister, my sister's boyfriend, Malcolm, was also a musician, a drummer in a band, and he introduced me to lots of really great musicians in the Barrow area, which is where I was from. Mm-hmm. I had a most fantastic teacher, music teacher, who... instead of teaching us Vaughan Williams, which is very nice, I do like that, but she taught us Bob Dylan songs and introduced us to Joan Baez and Judy Collins. And she taught me three chords, and at the time I was 13. And I went home and I played those three chords until I thought my parents were going to hang themselves. and that's really, that was my influence. And being introduced to that kind of music at that age was absolutely fantastic. It really was. And then I met a guy called Ronnie Smith, who is a blues singer from Barrow in Furness, who became my mentor in a way. And he introduced me when I was about 15 to, he gave me a load of albums, three of which were Joni Mitchell albums I'd never heard of her before. Sandy Denny, Fairport Convention. And I remember sitting on the bed with my mouth hanging open thinking, my God, I can't, but that's what I want to do. That is what I want to do. And I just didn't see anyone. I used to be a real Northern Club dancer and I used to love all that stuff, but I just stayed in, and I'm exactly what you probably did yourself. Mm-hmm. And just played in my bedroom, played at the folk club, any folk club, anywhere that would have me.
And sang.
Absolutely. Yeah, learning to play the guitar was a fantastic liberator for me, because as a singer, you've always got to have someone to play for you, mm-hmm. unless you can play yourself.
And, yeah, that's right.
That's one of the single most important things in my career, I think, learning how to accompany myself, because it's just so great to be able to pick up a guitar and go and sing. Yeah, so they were my roots, really.
Mm-hmm. And you obviously listened to Joni Mitchell a lot, didn't you?
I mean, I just was Joni Mitchell with a Barrow in Furness accent, believe
Is that
me.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, I was Joni Mitchell and I was Sandy Denny, and they were the two most important figures, and James Taylor, actually. Between them, they did everything. Sandy singing traditional songs with blues and soul in her voice, because I love soul music too, you know. And then you've got Joni Mitchell coming out of left field, doing everything differently, bearing her soul at the same time. And then James Taylor just washing this lovely stuff over you. And I think they're the three, I think, that I can sometimes, when I write or sing, I can sometimes figure out the derivative, you know, where it came from.
Sure, yeah. But then from there, you did the club circuit.
That's right. I met Joe when I was 17, and I was a solo singer up to that point.
Oh, right, yeah.
We both worked in a local factory in Barrow, and I met him at the folk club. He worked down at Lister's with me at the factory, and he was working a three-day week because of the strikes, the miners' strikes.
Mm-hmm.
So we both did three-day weeks, and he was a really good piano player and a songwriter and a good singer too. We used to go to his house, and we used to play the piano and the guitar, and I loved that, you know, because I loved the piano because Joni Mitchell played the piano.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was just great, and we got a set of songs off together, and on the 2 days off where we weren't working, in fact, we worked Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, which was fantastic, which left Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday to go off and play music. We used to go off to Lancaster, Manchester,
yeah,
Carlisle, yeah. Anywhere we could get to within those times. And play our songs. And so we were kind of around the northwest. Didn't make it as far as the great city of Preston, of course.
Oh, you didn't make it this far down?
No, it isn't. No.
and then, of course, along came motherhood, right?
Yeah, well, it was. Well, we left Barrow by then, and we were trying to be. I was trying to be a professional singer. And it was kind of Bill was Christine Mills, you know, with her boyfriend Joe Wild, kind of thing. And we were living together and doing little part-time jobs, and because I was a very naive young woman, and it was the kind of, you know, the contraceptive pill. Oh, it's all right, I missed today, I'll take two tomorrow, that one. Which you shouldn't do, girls out there, just in case you didn't know. So I found myself pregnant, and so we decided that whilst we were going to go back and he would need to get a job in order to keep us, that we'd have a couple. And so we had Danny and Kelly and lived the life of a, family. We did gigs. We took the kids out to gigs and festivals, but as long as we didn't have to go far, we were living in Manchester by then. And that's how life was for us, as semi-professional musicians for the next 17 years.
Yeah. So moving on now to the early 90s, I suppose you remember when you and I played the Fyle Festival.
I do.
And and the Albion Band were playing straight after us, weren't they?
That's right.
And Ashley must have heard us and
well, it was Julie Matthews, actually. She was leaving the band.
Yeah.
And she was with her duo partner at the time. Pat Shaw was with them. Ashley was outside playing with CDs, as is his way. and the merch boy, the barra boy, as I like to call him. And Julie came in to watch. And she ran outside and she said, Ashley. Because Ashley was looking for a new female vocalist for the band. Come and listen to this woman, come on in. So he came in and listened to it and thought that he'd found the new singer for the Albion Band. And he asked me for a cassette at the end of the concert, which I gave him. And he rang me up about 3 weeks later and asked me, would I join the Albion Band? I said, oh, no. No, thank you. He says, why not? He was really surprised. I said, because I've been playing with someone for 17 years and now I'm enjoying, I play with Ken Nicol, I'm enjoying my solo career, I've just got a new album out and blah, blah, blah. And I really like what I'm doing. And he said, oh, I really think you should reconsider. Anyway, about 2 weeks later, I get a call. He rang me twice more and I said no. And then I got a call from Phil Beer and he said, don't be so bloody stupid. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, Simon Nicol's in the band and this great fiddler called Ashley Reed. And it'll take you out the Northwest. It's going to take you everywhere. It'll take you around the world. Even if you stay in the band for 2 years, do it. And so I really thought seriously about it. And it was a great experience. He was right. I mean, it really did open the door for me to the rest of the country and the world, really.
But then after you'd been in the Albions for a certain period of time, Julie actually rejoined, didn't she?
Yeah, she came back. Simon Nicol had to leave. Ashley Reed had to leave the band. And Julie had done a couple of gigs with us. It just seemed natural. And we were doing some songs together by then. And she came back in the band and it was great. It was just like the folk ABBA, kind of thing. Julie and I were writing most of the content for the Albion Band. So it was very good. Very strong vocally with Simon Nicol as well.
The band became very focused, really, didn't it, on what you and Julie did?
Yes, it did. And the songs, I think our songs were the mainstay. We had a really good time for the next 5 years.
And it seemed like such a natural thing for the two of you then to go your separate ways from the band.
It did. I mean, we just... we were in a toilet once. It was one of these gigs where there wasn't a separate dressing room toilet, and we just... Julie was... in one of these washrooms and everything, and she had these two women talking and they were talking about us, and so she didn't like coming out of the stall, you know, because it would have been really embarrassing. And one was saying to the other, girls are great, those women, aren't they? And the other one was saying, yeah, they actually, what do they need those bloody blocks for?
that was it, it sold her, that, did it?
It was just kind of in a very extreme way of putting, actually, that we were moving away and that we were so powerful as a duo. We didn't really need the instrumental and the bass, which were lovely, you know. It was a great band. But it was changing as well. We got Joe Broughton in the band by then. He was going into different time signatures and more instrumentals that didn't really suit me and Julie, to be honest.
Right.
And Ashley was a bit ashen-faced at the prospect of us leaving, but, you know, as Ashley does, he moved on and he got another great band together.
Okay, well, that's when I moved in.
And that's when you joined. And Kelly took my place.
And Kelly, that's right. Kelly, your daughter, took your place.
Oh, it was so weird because she picked us up from the airport from Australia in 1997. And she said, I've joined the Albion Band. It's really weird because all of a sudden I felt like kind of an antique that had been, replaced by a younger
version. So how many years now have you and Julie been performing as Wael and Matthews?
The first time we worked together was in 1995 is when we first toured. We went to Canada together. So, it's 12 years.
Yes,
it's 12 years. Yeah.
And how many albums have you done in that time, do you know?
Yeah, we've made 6 studio albums and a live double album.
Uh-huh.
And now we've just produced the best of Wael & Matthews. All so right. That's taken in the last 12 years. Yeah, 15 tracks. So that was hard to choose.
I should imagine it was, yes. You got all these other projects as well, you do. St. Agnes Fountain, for example.
St. Agnes Fountain with Chris Leslie and David Hughes, putting the groove back into Christmas.
All right.
really enjoying that. Just such a... such good fun. And we've done Blue Tapestry as
Blue
well
Tapestry,
over the last
yeah.
5 or 6 years, which is the music of Joni Mitchell and Carole King, which was a bit of a dream come true for me and Julie being brought up on Carole King, me being brought up on Joni Mitchell, and of course playing with Pete Zorn. Oh, he's so wonderful.
Oh, Pete's great, isn't he?
Well, we both love him, don't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
He's just the most fantastic musician. And he played bass in the band, and Martin Alcock played the guitars, and of course the great mm-hmm. Neil Marshall, one of the best drummers on earth.
Absolutely.
Just
yeah.
great.
Yeah.
Just great. And we'd have done Daphne's Flight with Christine Collister, Melanie Harold, and the great Helen Watson. Mm-hmm. That was a kind of 5-piece female harmony group. And now I've just made a new album with Kelly.
So you've been moderately busy. So when you do eventually get home, how do you relax? I mean, what do you do when you get home? What do you do to
well,
relax?
Well, it's funny. I go on eBay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I love doing a bit of bartering on eBay. I do a bit of that, and I do a little bit of graphics work with a computer. I like that. I get off to spend quite a bit of time in Birmingham, where I've got lots of friends and a partner, and walking. I've got into walking, so I've lost a lot of weight in the last couple of years, and I've got much fitter, and I never used to be able to walk, because I used to have to walk with a stick, because I have very dodgy knees, but it's fantastic now. So I'm going to 5-6 mile walks, got myself walking boots, and I love that. I do love being in the countryside and walking. It's beautiful. So I do
mm-hmm.
love that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that sounds yeah. great.
It's only us since I was with you, but even so, it seems like years. So many words unsaid between us, hang in the air. I have so much I want to tell you, but I am scared to push that far. Could I reach out my heart and touch you and find out who you really are? But there's a
there's a 100 miles between.
anyway, you've got a new CD project happening now, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. I've been in the studio a fortnight ago with Joe Broughton, who's co-producing it with me and recording it. I don't know if you people out there know, but Joe Broughton is a student of the Conservatoire Music School in Birmingham, and an extremely fine classical violinist.
Mm-hmm. He teaches, though, doesn't he?
He teaches at the Conservatoire, mm-hmm. and he loves the people there. I mean, he's got a huge folk orchestra, and they're all kids from the Conservatoire.
Yeah.
And they go on a coach trip and play at places. I think there's something like 45 people in the band. He's also a conductor and an arranger, and he's writing string quartet parts for some of the songs for mm-hmm. the album. Mm-hmm. So it's lovely. We've got Jerry Conway on drums from Fairport, of course, and Pentangle, and Neil Fairclough on bass, who used to be with E2K, absolutely fantastic bass mm-hmm. player. And then there's the kids from the Conservatoire. We've got Eddie Reader coming in to do some vocals, Paul Brady, uh-huh. and Kelly, of course, she'll be there. But just lovely. It's different for me. And Kevin Dempsey's doing some work with me. And I just wanted to do a project with people that I had never worked with before, just to see where it would go and what would happen to the songs. I just wanted to take a different path.
Uh-huh.
And I'm really enjoying the experience, and I'm just going with it. I'm just going with it, and it's great. It's just great.
Chris, it's Phil here. Hi.
Hello, Phil.
It must be a strange feeling for a songwriter to actually, having written the song and maybe recorded it, but the recording isn't released yet, so the audience doesn't know that song, to actually let it go and perform it in public. How difficult is that for?
Well, it's essential in a way, because before I do the final vocal on that song, I want to know it well. I want to know it more. I want to know it intimately and where it's going. Because inevitably, if you write a song just before an album, you record it, and 12 months later, you're singing it, the soul with it. You know, it's so much better the way you sing it a year later, or maybe 6 months later. And so over the last few years, both Julie and I have tried to do that, tried to introduce the songs first, so that by the time the album comes out, they're almost a friend to people, and they really want to hear them.
You're talking about the solo album. What does a solo album give you that working with Julie or within a band doesn't give you?
Well, it makes you think for yourself. The decisions are down to you, and you need to find other people to work with. And of course, you've got, because Julie and I, the sound that we make together is the sound of two soloists coming together. Yeah, well, there's Julie, there's me, and there's Chris and Julie. Now, Chris and Julie is a completely different musician. That's how I see it. It's like a third party, almost, the two of us together. It's rather like, you know, Dick Emery when he stands in the corner of the shop, you know, and he makes a new image. It's a little bit like that. And so when Julie made a solo album last year or year before called Slow, it's completely different to what we do together. And I think the same goes for me. It's just naturally different.
And do you write differently for a solo album than you would for a collaborative album, because you know that the other party maybe wouldn't like the song or wouldn't like the approach you take?
Maybe that happens unconsciously. What does happen consciously is that I always, because I've been brought up by these singers, you know, grown up with these singers like Joni Mitchell and Sandy Denny or whatever, great vocalists, that I like to use the range of my voice if I can. Well, you can't do that always in a duo, because you've got to think about the harmonies. Harmonies are much stronger when they're simple. And that's just a fact. Mm. When you have to listen to Alison Krauss, you get these great choruses, great strong harmonies coming from simple tunes. But as a soloist, you get a little bit more elbow room to you know, do some more twists and turns and go to different areas. I think you can be a little bit more self-indulgent, not too much, but a little bit more when you're solo.
Mm. And maybe open up, as it's much more personal.
Absolutely.
Record if it's got your name on it.
Yeah, the songs you can have me I in it much more than you can with it when you're collaborative.
So tell me, Chris, is writing something you have to make yourself do, or do you just do it quite spontaneously?
Oh my God, you've got to put a firework in my shoe. I hate it. I really hate it. I would, Julie's shouting through the room now, I'd rather do a stack of ironing.
Rather.
I'd rather double dig a vegetable patch than make myself sit down and write a song.
Well, if you have any of those jobs for me to do as well, I'll
I know.
I'll help
Except
you.
Except for you. You're like Julie Matthews. You can just let you lock yourself in a room and write. You both are good at that. I know it's like rolling off a log.
Well,
but those really serious ones that mean a lot to you, that are really successful, they're the harder ones, aren't they? They're the harder ones to come up with.
They can be. It's quite hard to quantify the whole.
It totally. Process, really. I mean, this year I've been a good year for me. I think I've written 5 songs. That is a good year for me. You know, sometimes I can go through and write 2 songs in a year. But it's been in the last 2 years I've probably written 10, which is really good, and I've got loads of ideas on the go at the moment. And I went through a real writing phase round about from last autumn through to June this year. I was buzzing with it. And I always think I'm never going to be able to write another song. That's my failing. I never think I can, because I lived with a man for years that told me I couldn't because I didn't have a formal education or whatever, you know, and he was a writer. You can't write it. You're not clever enough. And so I didn't. So I'm a bit scared of it. It's a little bit... I've got a neurosis about it. But when I do settle down and do it, of course I can.
Would you like me to go around and sort this guy out for you?
Yes, please. No, it's good. It's good because when he did finally leave me for the younger model, I proved him wrong that I could. And I wrote a lot of You Bastard songs, which is still on fire.
I think life's like that, isn't it? It's really just a process of proving people wrong. So, looking like into the future, I mean, do you have anything in particular like that you're aiming towards? What are your ambitions?
Well, to get this album out in the next 6 months. Julie and I are looking to go back to Canada next year. We haven't been to Canada for, I think the last time we went was 1996, and it's a fantastic country to play, the best festivals on earth, fantastic artist-friendly festivals, beautiful. So we want to go to Canada. Because, you know, it's a short life in this country. There's only so many clubs you can play. There's a lot of clubs, but there's only so many venues and art centres that you can play in a year, isn't there? You know, so you do need to spread your wings and go off and do other countries. And we spend about 2 months every 2 or 3 months every other year in Australia, where we have a wonderful career. I think we're very lucky. We're all very lucky to be making our living doing this wonderful thing.
Will there be any more Nickel and Weil shows to
I see? Hope so. Do you know, I think we just loved it, Ken and I, because it's a stress-free situation for us, because we get on very well. We have a very nice time, and we're musically very compatible. Yeah. But having time to learn some new songs is what we have to do. We have to make some time. And it would be lovely to do a cluster of gigs together, the way we could really start firing.
I think so. It's just choosing the time,
exactly.
Isn't it?
When it's not getting in the way of our other projects, and where we can have some space for it.
That's right. Cool,
but yes, I'd love to.
Me too. Just one more question from me. It might be a bit of a hard one, this, but in years to come, how do you think you might want to be remembered?
Ooh. I think, you know, if people can remember you, think... Do you remember that great night we had when Chris Weil was singing, and when she sang that song and it made us, you know, hold hands a bit closer? Or that's really what that are my intentions when I get up to sing, is to communicate with people and, you know, hopefully extend my living room to them within the cavern of a hall, you know, whatever. What I want to do, and if people go home and they felt like they know me a little bit, that makes me really happy.
Well, that sounds like a very good sentiment to finish on.
And I think you're succeeding wonderfully well as well. So you're doing a good job, Chris.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Chris, for being on Folkcast.
Thank you. Bye.
together then would never end when our love was young. But now the darkness is my friend, now that love is gone. Who will quell this burning fire in this well of deep desire? Who'll be the moon and the sun? Now that love is gone, we slept entwined, our bodies bound eternally when our love was young. But now you lay so far from me, now that love is gone.
Thanks to Chris. Check out our website for a list of dates she's playing with Julie in the run-up to December, when she swaps hats to one covered in tinsel and heads back out on the road with St Agnes Fountain.
And that's all we have time for this month, which means that that was Folkcast 010, or Folkcast 10 even, for October 2006. An independent podcast produced and presented in Preston, England, by Ken Nicol, that's me.
And Phil Widows, that's me.
Starring Black Rat, Pablo's Cat, Ralph McTell, Graham Bellinger, Caroline Lavelle, Piefinger, Shira Carmen and Andy Smythe. Our special guest star was the fabulous Chris Weil. Uncle Baba came to you courtesy of the field recording skills of Mike Master Merrick.
Our special thanks to the Podsafe Music Network, the Woven Wheat Whispers and Magnitude Music Download Services, and to you for downloading and listening to us. Visit the show notes page at folkcast.co.uk for full details of all the music we played this month. Please support the artists you hear on Folkcast by following the links from our show notes to their websites, where often you can find even more great music. Also, join the Folkcast community by putting your pin in the Folkcast Frapper map, wherever in the world you may be, and chatting to fellow folk fans via the Frapper forum. Follow the links from our website, www.folkcast.co.uk.
The next Folkcast will probably be available from the first Saturday of next month. Until then, here to play us out with the tunefully topical Autumn Gold is Andy Smythe. So keep focused on Folkcast and keep our finger in your ear.
Geese migrate in timeless forms, eyes fixed on horizons warm. Their wings a fluid beat, shadows all they leave. Let's grab this final chance, thinking free, acting fast, guiding instinct.
Well, say hello, Julie.
Hello,
Julie. You're all right?
Yeah, I'm all right. I've just been walking my dogs while you lot have been, you know, changing the face of modern folk music.
Julie's turn soon, isn't it? She can do one.
Absolutely, yeah, it'd be great.